blurted out. No! We were swimming in the pool on Volta Place. Papa asked, his anger rising higher.
Who are you sneaking out to see and keeping time with? A young girl like you keeping time with boys already? I declare, that's what I've been talking about, woman.
Hush a minute and give her time to tell it. Let her tell it, Mama said.
Go on and tell it, Johnny,
she said firmly. Papa and Mama sat at the kitchen table and went silent as stones, watching her mouth as if they didn't trust their ears and would have to read her lips. It took her some moments to gather up the story and tell it coherently. She spoke evenly and included all the details of her and Pearl going to the pool, climbing the fence, swimming in the water, and being caught.
The police? The police caught you in there?
Papa broke in, and the fear in his voice was considerable. Johnny May collapsed into a chair. Mama sat down, too, and pulled her chair up close to Johnny May.
Go on, she said. We scrambled up out of the pool, she continued, and he caught my foot and held on to me. Officer Davis, it was Toby Davis saw y'all?
Papa barked at her. He looked at his wife solemnly.
Yes, sir, she said,
and continued the tale, telling them all about Pearl throwing stink balls on top of Toby Davis's head. Papa banged the kitchen table with his fist and stood up.
God, this is a bad situation.
He sat back down and rubbed his forehead with his palm. The coffee that Willie had drunk started to worry his stomach. The bottom of his belly felt like a smoldering fire. He wanted to belch and clear it or put something soft in it to sop up the acidy coffee. Alice took bacon and eggs from the icebox and started to assemble a breakfast. Willie's nerves were calmed some by the fried eggs and bread. Alice tried to eat something, but her stomach turned at the sight of the eggs. She warmed a glass of milk, and after Johnny May had drunk half of it, she ushered her up the stairs to bed. Nobody wanted to make much of the incident except Toby Davis. He was good and sore about being pelted with stink balls, but after he told his story to the desk sergeant at number 7, there was little interest in rounding up the perpetrators. Sergeant Michael Cronin told him to forget it, especially since he couldn't say exactly who the two nigger gals were. He was told to pay closer attention to the swimming pool on his rounds. Keep the little niggers from getting in the pool in the first place, Cronin bellowed. Cronin, who considered himself sympathetic toward colored, followed a policy of seeking out a reliable representative when there was a potential problem. And if pickaninnies continued to sneak into the whites' only pool, there was going to be a problem. So he sent Peanut Walter with a note to Reverend Buford Jenkins, telling him to come down to number 7 to discuss a situation. When Peanut Walter arrived, Buford Jenkins came out of the small anteroom off to the side of his parlor, where he'd been working on his record books. He'd been noting down the names of those married and baptized and laid to rest since the last time he'd gotten around to working on the church records. The pastors of Mount Zion Church had been keeping records of the whereabouts and circumstances of their members since the church was founded. In the times before emancipation, the pastors had cryptically recorded the fate of members who disappeared due to tragic or mysterious circumstances as lost. People who were captured by patrollers or bounty hunters and returned to the Deep South were listed as taken away. The lucky or brave ones who were sent farther along the Underground Railroad to Harper's Ferry and on north to Canada were noted as gone away. After reading the note Peanut Walter handed him, Reverend Jenkins closed the record books and put on his suit coat. Jenkins paused in front of a mirror and vigorously brushed his hair.
Many a man is sorry to see gray hairs pop up around his temples, but Buford Jenkins was happy to see them. With a bulbous nose that was occasionally decorated with a black-headed pustule, he was not considered a good-looking man. Gray hairs helped him look dignified rather than comical. This was all to the good around white folks, especially the official ones. They liked to have someone they could talk to who could speak up for the Negro race with a suit and tie on. And in relations with whites, a colored person always needed an introduction or a tell. A colored man needed some subtlety of appearance, like gray temples or a limp, that proclaimed a mild intention. Bethel Jenkins, his mama, had raised no fool. Jenkins had sense enough not to wear his best suit or his best shoes down to the police station to see Michael Cronin. Clean and slightly threadbare, that was the best way to dress for talking to the white folks. When Jenkins arrived, Sergeant Michael Cronin told him plainly that folks weren't going to tolerate colored children getting in their swimming pool at night. He advised Reverend Jenkins to find out who they were and warned them to stay out of there. He described the perpetrators as two young girls, and the police wouldn't be responsible if something untoward happened to half-naked colored children running the streets at night. The general description of each of the two girls and the direction in which they'd run sounded like one of them must be Johnny Mae Bynum. Reverend Jenkins knew he'd have to go speak to the Bynums about this matter. Sunday morning, the Bynum household lingered long over their breakfast. Johnny Mae waited for her mama to give her permission to leave the table to dress for Sunday services. But Mama kept her eyes to herself and said nothing. She sipped coffee and pushed her food around on her plate without speaking. Aunt Ina, too, was silent, and Papa surrendered his coffee cup after a long while and went out back to his garden. Nobody acted like he or she meant to go to church that day. Was it such a monstrous thing she'd done that they couldn't even go to church? Reverend Jenkins had called the previous evening and had spoken to Mama and Papa in the parlor. His voice had been sympathetic. He had said more than once that he understood it from the girl's point of view. He felt that having places like that pool where colored children couldn't go was shameful and plain wrong. But there wasn't anything they could do about it now. And for her own sake, she had better stay out of that pool. The two women sat with their Bibles in the parlor after breakfast and read silently. This time they blamed her. What she had done at the pool had caused the shame they were feeling. And her mama and papa and Aunt Ina were not inclined to relieve her misery with exculpatory pats and murmurings. Their glances at her were hard, and though they didn't require her to, she felt that she must sit in the parlor with them and their Bibles and her own Bible. Johnny Mae could never remember Miss Ella Bromson coming up to the front door of their house. She always came through the backyard and scratched at the screen door like somebody they'd always known. It was the country in her, Aunt Ina said, and the fact of her Indian blood. And in the late afternoon after church services, Miss Ella Bromson came through the backyard, exchanged courtesies with Papa, and came into the house and through to the parlor. Mama and Aunt Ina looked up, startled. Miss Ella Bromson came into the parlor carrying a brand new broom with a handle nearly as tall as she was.
Sister Alice, Sister Ina Mae, we missed you at services today.
Johnny Mae detected a wash of shame over her mother and her aunt. They knew they'd been wallowing in their shamefacedness, and this mild rebuke caused more. Aunt Ina closed her Bible, popped up from her chair, and moved to offer Miss Ella a seat.
Ella, take a seat, and won't you have a cup of coffee and a piece of cake?
No, ma'am. Thank you. I've come to do a thing and have a word with you and Sister Alice.
Johnny May rose at the pointed look her mother gave her and went out to the kitchen.
Johnny May, take your mother's sweeping broom and put it on the back porch,
Ella called after her. Mama and Aunt Ina looked at her in surprise. Ella Bromson's reputation as an odd bird was well earned. She proceeded to use the new broom she'd brought to sweep around the periphery of the parlor rug, starting in the farthest corner from where she'd come into the room. She continued around the room, swirling what little dust there was in the room and collecting it back at the spot she'd started from. She swept the few dust balls into her palm and gave them to Alice.
Sister Alice, take your troubles outside and throw them away.
Alice looked Ella Bromson full in the eyes. She was surely a mad woman, but she'd come with her hands open and her eyes clear. Alice closed her hands over the dust motes and went and released them over the back porch rail. When she came back to the parlor, Ella was sitting in a chair as ordinary as any Sunday caller. The tall broom leaned against the inside of the front door. When Ella left by the back door, she took the Bynum's used broom and carried it under her left armpit like a lance. She passed Johnny May on the back porch and said to the girl as she passed,
"Don't give your mama no more trouble, girl."
Chapter 20. Alice and Ina packed Johnny May's things and set out the clothes she would wear without consulting her on choices. Alice figured this would be the last time she would decide things for Johnny May. She wasn't much more than a child, but she was going away like a woman. She was taking a grown person's concerns with her. Clara was gone, and now Johnny May was going. Would she ever come back to them as a girl? Alice had finally lost the argument with Willie. They had thrashed and tussled verbally in the kitchen, in the bedroom, in the parlor. Willie had insisted that Johnny May had got wild, and there was nothing Alice could say to persuade him that the girl should stay. He went on and on about Johnny May getting out of hand and insisted that they couldn't control her. Why, they couldn't even keep her in her bed at night. What kind of shame was she going to bring on them next? At least down home, there wouldn't be any swimming pools or bad influences. Old man Walker would see to that. Willie held firm to the idea that Johnny May couldn't stay in Georgetown with people knowing she'd been involved in the event at the pool. If she could go away for the rest of the summer, maybe this thing would be forgotten. They would tell folks that she was going south to visit her aunts. Alice countered that it wouldn't matter whether she went away or not. If people knew about the pool, they knew about the pool. Alice dictated a terse message to old man Walker at the Western Union office.
"We'll arrive Rutherfordton tomorrow. Your granddaughter, Johnny May Bynum."
Johnny May had said very little in the days since the pool incident. Not only her ears, but her face was burning with their fussing and fuming. She knew she'd done wrong in going out at night and breaking into the pool. She knew she'd done wrong to drag Pearl Miller into the scheme. And she was wrong to swim in the white people's pool. But nobody would be able to convince her that swimming was wrong. And even Reverend Jenkins himself said that it was wrong for them to keep colored children from swimming in that pool. But Papa and Mama were still talking about her and all the shame she had brought down onto their heads. Mrs. Miller had even said that Johnny May was a bad influence on Pearl, and she forbade Pearl to have anything to do with her. The past few days, the two girls had had to sneak around to get a chance to talk to each other. The plans were set. Papa and Mama were going to send her by train to her grandpop's farm in North Carolina, at least for the rest of the summer. Maybe for the rest of her life. She marshaled all her reserves of pluck just to keep straight the things she must do on the train trip. Had in her ticket, look after her bag and her lunch,
and the things she must not do. Talk to strangers, forget her purse, or her bag, or lunch, or where she was to change trains, or where she was to get off the train. She was quiet, calm, in control of herself as she rode across town on the streetcar with her parents and aunt and baby Calvin to Union Station. The group walked solemnly into the waiting room at Union Station. Mr. Ernest Boston hailed them at once, in a voice that was well modulated but resonant in the cavernous room. He hurried across the room in short, quick steps. Whenever Georgetown children traveled by train, Mr. Ernest Boston was sought out and asked to keep an eye on the young traveler. And Mr. Ernest Boston considered it his particular responsibility to assure the colored families that no harm would come to any child traveling on his train. Willie, Alice, and Ina were quite comfortable with delivering Johnny May into his care. "Miss Johnny May, you look so grown I wouldn't have known you if your mama wasn't with you." Mr. Ernest Boston bent toward her and smiled as if she were a tiny child needing to be comforted. "You all don't need to worry. I'll look after her till we get to Raleigh, and then I'll hand her over to Mr. Sam Gray, and he'll get her to your folks in Rutherfordton. We'll drink a glass of milk in Richmond after we change trains, and we'll ride in style all the way. Many a child younger than you rides the train by themselves. You're looking glum, Johnny May. Cheer up. When this train leaves the station, it's gonna eat up the tracks. We'll be there before you know it." It was expected that she would smile appreciatively toward Mr. Ernest Boston, and she did so. Though her face felt as if it would dissolve into mush, she did not want to cry. Though how on earth was she going to help herself when it was time to board the train and leave them all? She wanted to grab hold of baby Calvin and bury her head in his warm, fat stomach. She knew if she did this, he would giggle uncontrollably, and this would make her feel better. Mama was carrying a large cardboard box tied up with string that contained Johnny May's lunch. Papa was carrying the suitcase that had her clothes, and Aunt Ina was huffing and puffing under the burden of Calvin's solid bulk. Nobody had said anything all the whole way across town on the streetcar. Truth to tell, Alice had a feeling that Willie was regretting this decision, but was too much a rooster to admit it. She had been thinking about how she might maneuver him into being able to change his mind, but time was running out. Sending Johnny May back home seemed to her like walking backward. What did they come to Washington for if not to get better for Johnny May and Clara? But Clara was gone, and there was Calvin now. What good was it going to do to send Johnny May away from them when they especially needed her now to care for Calvin? After Mr. Ernest Boston had left them to their goodbyes and had pointed out where to get on the train, the Bynum family stood in silence. The Roman soldiers standing at attention around the periphery of the lobby's vaulted ceiling respected their silence, their heads slightly bowed and their bodies still. All around the group, people hurried past to reach their trains. If the angel Gabriel had blown the last great blast on his trumpet, the Bynums and Ina Carson would not have moved. Only Calvin wiggled and twisted in Aunt Ina's arms. They were stopped in the middle of Union Station, considering how to proceed. Alice plucked the lunchbox down on the floor at her feet, set her jaw, and wrenched and tugged at her hat, changing its placement and then resettling it in its original place.
"You can't send my baby off down south," she blurted at her husband.
He looked up and saw a furious determination on her face and rocked back on his heels.
"You can't separate my babies and my heart. You're a man, but you're only one man. I've got a say in what happens to the child out of my body, and I say that she stays or I go with her. I'll take this boy, too. I'll raise them out of my pocket if I have to, but I won't be separated from them."
Ina Carson drew herself up at her cousin's words, and though she didn't mix in, you could tell what side of the stream she was on. She thrust Calvin's fat, wiggling body into Alice's arms.
What the matter with you women? You crazy or something? What kind of thing are you talking now?
Willie sputtered, and his eyes bulged in alarm, and though he was not entirely ready to give up his peek, he was relieved that things had begun to take a turn. Johnny May had to be controlled somehow, and if they couldn't do it, maybe it would be better to send her back south before something bad happened. But maybe they shouldn't go off half-cocked. They did need her for taking care of the baby. And if the women were going to act this way,
what kind of example you setting for this girl? You raising your voice at me in this public place?
Alice stood straight and stared at him without reply. She had provoked him and was letting him carry on in the full knowledge that the storm had, in fact, passed. They were going to be able to go back home together. Willie snorted and harrumphed at his wife and rolled his eyes, but gradually calmed. Alice had given him a way out of this tangle, but he was still not content with things. This swimming. This was the thing that seemed to be the cause of the trouble. It seemed like with this swimming, Johnny May had got to feeling that she could do whatever she liked. That wasn't no way for a young girl to behave. Willie stood for a time with his hat in his hands. He stared at the marble floor of the station. Looking at him, one would have thought he was reading auguries in the highly buff stone. Johnny May, who'd had her eyes averted to the floor, looked up to see a short, dark figure standing off a ways, looking intently at her. She thought it must be Pearl Miller, and got ashamed that she'd not said a proper goodbye to Pearl. It was Pearl standing there. Pearl had come to beg her not to go. Pearl was her best friend, and she had come down to beg Johnny May's parents to let her stay. The sun that streamed in from the east-facing windows made it difficult for Johnny May to read the features of the figure. Was she smiling? Was she mad at Johnny May for not saying a proper goodbye? In fact, all that could be discerned was that it was the figure of a girl. Yet there was something askew. The girl was not standing so far distant that her features should have appeared so muddy. But they were muddy. There was no other girl it could have been. Yet she actually looked too childlike to be Pearl. Johnny May puzzled. It had to be Pearl, but it couldn't be. Pearl would not have worn the ribbon in her hair attached to the very end of her plait. Pearl would not have had the little white ankle socks. Pearl would have called out or smiled or come closer. Johnny May broke the spell of silence that had the Bynums and Ina Carson frozen in a tableau. She called out, "Hey!" and started toward the girl, who turned and ran toward the revolving brass doors leading out of Union Station.
Chapter 21. In the earliest hours of daylight, the breeze off the Potomac carries the fragrances of wild places upriver and the flora that inhabit them. Air comes down from these places, stoops low over Rock Creek, and blows back across Georgetown, bringing along a scent that has no name other than morning. Johnny May sat before a pile of onions, blowing short breaths between her lips. She wanted to sigh, to expel a long, slow chestful of air. But sighing annoyed her mother so. Mama disapproved of it as a behavior for young girls. She never sighed herself, and she never let one of Johnny May's sighs go unnoticed. "Sighing will age you," she said now, going back into a closet of aphorisms and mother wit mumbo jumbo. "Now isn't that the silliest thing?" Johnny May thought, hoping her mother wouldn't be able to read these impudent thoughts on her forehead. Mama continued, "You see, you turn that sigh into a yawn, and it'll clear you out. A yawn will give you strength
to get started again. A sigh leaves you down with nowhere to go. Then you have to wait for your second wind.
Johnny May cultivated her puff-puffing. The work of fixing extra-large portions of potato salad, bean salad, fried chicken, and all the required summer picnic foods was boring.
Johnny May handled the mountains of onions assigned to her competently, pulling their skins off quickly. She dabbed her eyes and blinked, but skinned and cut the onions deftly.
Mama peeled from a pile of hot white potatoes and supervised Johnny May. The two worked along quietly.
Johnny May shifted her hips to settle herself on the chair. The unaccustomed cloths between her legs were chafing her.
Alice glanced up without moving her head to study the girl slyly. She hadn't said much, didn't ask any questions about starting her monthly.
For many years, the last Thursday before Labor Day had been the traditional day for the Mount Zion Church picnic under the P Street Bridge. Spread out along the P Street beach, it was the biggest social event of the summer. Women who cooked for a living 5 or 6 days a week had been up much of the night preparing the picnic and were up again at sunrise. Cakes were made the day before, chicken fried early in the morning, and potato salad mixed and cooled.
Daughters had strict instructions for assembling and cleaning and being ready.
A full 2 days before the picnic, Ina Carson had buried a skinless young pig in a brick-lined pit in her backyard, covered it with basil and sage, and built a slow-burning wood fire atop it, just like Cap used to do.
Carolina Slippin' and Hidin' Buried in the Ground Roasted Shote had been one of his favorite dishes.
Cap used to say that the fact that his daddy had risked the road gang or even his life in stealing the shote from Cal Jackson when stores were low made it taste extra good. His daddy did this when he and all the kids and Cap's mam had got tired of the wild taste of game.
Daddy Carson roasted the shote really slow for 5 days or so. He tended it all by himself, guarding the fire and stoking it, not wanting to risk anybody else's life but his own. He wouldn't even hint as to where he had stashed it. When it was done, he'd haul it to their table. And when they were done eating it, Daddy Carson buried the bones in an iron chest under the cabin to foil Cal Jackson's dogs, which people like to say had the power of augury and could find a missing bone before it was lost.
Ina's shote had come honestly with a pretty soft skin that she rubbed down with salt and pepper. It came up out of the ground that Thursday morning with its flesh crisp brown and barely clinging to the bone and smelling like backwoods Carolina.
Johnny May saved the biggest onion in the pile for last. It was the size of a softball, with a thick brown-striped skin. Under the shiny skin were two halves, joined with the line between the two halves and the hint of another skin.
Mama noticed Johnny May's change of rhythm and looked down at the girl's hands to see what she was looking at.
"That onion you're peeling, let me see it," she demanded.
Johnny May looked up, puzzled, and held out the onion for her mother to see.
Mama's nose turned up into a hard wrinkle.
"Put it down. Put it in the garbage. That's no good."
For the life of her, Johnny May couldn't see what was wrong with the thing. She'd been careful to root out any soft-spotted ones. This one was firm and certainly had a sweet, pungent sting.
"What's the matter, Mama?"
"That's a double-sided onion,"
Alice continued.
"That's bad luck. Throw it out. Don't ever use a double-sided onion, Johnny. It's bad luck. Don't even finish peeling it. They say a double-sided onion will divide your house against itself."
Johnny May snickered as she let the onion fall into the pan of garbage scraps. It never ceased to amaze her how many odd things a person had to remember simply to get through the day. Things that had to be remembered because they weren't set down in any book she'd ever seen, and certainly weren't taught in school.
If you spilled salt, you had to quickly throw some over your left shoulder to ward off bad luck. Never sweep dirt in a circle, but out toward the door, and never from the doorstep in. Don't touch the milk pitcher when you've got your monthly, or the milk will curdle. The list of things not to do when you had your monthly was so long and arcane that Johnny May began to think that most were made up to keep a woman from doing anything at all. And all the grown women, she was one now, though except for this one messy, stinking, achy thing, she didn't feel like it, spent their time figuring if it was coming soon or late or not coming at all. And for all the figuring and wondering, they were all reluctant to speak out plainly about it. When they talked about their monthly, it was in croaking whispers through dissimulating lips. The annual Mount Zion Church picnic was the largest social gathering of Black Georgetowners. All kinds of public and private plans were being made. Some men were running over in their minds which big rock they'd tie a watermelon to so that the cool creek water would bathe it and chill it for after the heavy food was eaten. Kaline Brown's parlor was busy with folks slipping in for a bottle of home brew. At sunrise on the morning of the picnic, members of the Elks Club gathered at the P Street Beach to stake out the spot where they would set up a huge pot of coffee over an open fire. Members came hauling firewood from all over Georgetown. Mr. Pud Allen even went up Conduit Road to get hickory wood because he so loved the smell of hickory burning under boiling coffee. By noon, most of the family groups had found a good spot to spread out their baskets, and teams had been chosen for baseball and horseshoes. Johnny May's favorite picnic game was the three-legged race, but she'd made herself scarce and hadn't been chosen for a team. After she helped her mama get settled in a good picnic spot, Pearl left her exchanging pleasantries with Dr. Hiawatha Parmalee and his wife.
"Your Pearl is coming up to be a nice-looking young lady, Sister Hattie," Mrs. Parmalee said, once hello and how do had passed back and forth among the three. "Praise God, she's got all my looks now, and some of her papa's too," Pearl heard her mother say as she walked off.
Hattie Miller had, by dint of conscientious attendance at church services and women's auxiliary meetings, become well thought of at Mount Zion Church. Pearl wove in and out of clumps of people, looking for Johnny May. She found her finally, off by herself at the edge of the creek, sitting on a boulder. Pearl dropped down beside Johnny May and waited for her to acknowledge her presence. Behind them was the laughing and shouting of the picnickers, and in front of them was a merry splashing and sloshing of water over rocks. The creek was gently conversational, a gaggle of happy voices. The words were indistinct, but the sound was of a group happily talking and enjoying their exchange. The people at the picnic behind them on the grassy knoll of the P Street Beach were also happily enjoying one another's company. Johnny May imagined them talking among themselves and not including her. All were part of a confederacy of adults talking about grown people's things and not including her or any of the babies. And Pearl was now part of them. Pearl, who used to be a scared rabbit who wouldn't make a sound, was now up among them talking about things in a code of womanly dissembling. That day, Pearl's mood had been bright until she came upon Johnny May. She was now more successful socially, having won the friendship of a few more of the girls at school. It was through Johnny May that she'd acquired these friends, and Pearl felt she owed her a special loyalty. But today, a day when all of Georgetown was lighthearted and playful, Johnny May was moping and shying away from the activities. Pearl was afraid that sitting on rocks with water all around was having a saddening effect on her. Perhaps that was what was making her sulky.
"What's wrong, Johnny May?"
Pearl, tired of the silence on a day when all else and whosoever was laughing and giggling, asked tentatively.
"Nothing," she said,
"the kind of nothing that begs, ask me and ask me again till I tell you.
Something's the matter, I can tell."
"Nothing. Something's the matter.
What's the matter?"
It took a couple of sputtery tries before Johnny May managed to tell Pearl that she'd finally got her monthly.
"Is that all?"
"Johnny May, you're crazy," she said in the exasperating way she had recently acquired. Pearl was suddenly so womanly that every comment she made sounded like smug pity. She was smug because she'd got her monthly a few months ago and was now quite used to it. After an hour or so on the boulder in the sun, the two girls succumbed to the lure of fried chicken and potato salad. Like the other young people, they circulated the picnic grounds and took plates of food at every family grouping they passed. At the bake sale table, each bought a piece of cake for a penny and relished choosing a slice of cake other than her mama's. Pearl's mother's lemon cake was completely gone anyway, and Alice Bynum's chocolate layer cake was down to the last crumpling slice. Mabel Dockery's mother was the cake slicer and was installed in a chair at one end of the long table on which the cakes were placed. Her fat arms didn't rise from her sides as she cut the cakes, and between each slice, they came to rest across her wide middle. Talk around the cake stand was all about whether it was proper for Dr. Tyler to be so openly enamored of Miss Gladys Perryman, with his wife dead only 3 months. Johnny May was surprised at the way Pearl had got all the salient facts of the big scandal and expressed the opinion that Miss Gladys Perryman was the prettiest woman in Georgetown. Gladys Perryman was not the only woman at the picnic with a parasol, but she was the only one whose parasol exactly matched the soft, bright yellow of her dress. The dress hugged her slim figure more closely than some of the talkers thought was proper, but all agreed that she cut a lovely swath while promenading on the arm of Dr. Tyler. Sari Tyler, wearing a close-cropped head of shiny curls, just like Gladys Perryman's, followed behind the couple, absorbing what was left of the admiring glances bestowed on the two. Gladys Perryman had established herself quite firmly in Georgetown. She was a fixture at cultural functions, sponsored by the Heliotrope Circle, and at the numerous social club functions held at Monticello House. And now there was talk that she would soon open a proper beauty shop and a storefront on P Street. Pearl Miller, never much for running and jumping, had of late become a real stick in the mud. She shook her head at Johnny May's urgings to cavort, racing headlong up the hill toward P Street and calling out over her shoulder for Pearl to follow. Johnny May looked back to see an expression of polite indulgence about the girl's eyes, the kind of look any grown-up would turn on a too playful child. Pearl's steps were measured and suddenly graceful, and she strove mightily to imitate the elegant swoop and dip gait that Gladys Perryman accomplished so effortlessly. Johnny May was puzzled at the change and couldn't suppress the feeling that she and Pearl had parted company and were now on different sides of a divide. When Pearl reached the top of the hill breathing hard, Johnny May smiled. Johnny May got tired of feeling like a baby around Pearl and walked off from her. Pearl had fallen in with a group of girls from their class and was jabbering and trading tales. The conversation got most animated when Charlie Edward Hughes was brought up. Everybody and his brother was at the picnic and all seemed intimately involved with someone. Johnny May felt excluded. Why, her mother had even said that Johnny May need not bother to look after little Calvin today. And right now, her mother was holding court with Calvin on the grass, surrounded by cooing women and a particularly talkative Aunt Ina. They were all acting like they'd never even seen a baby before. Miss Ruby Tilson, amiable but as plain as a muddy brown wren, was babbling nonsense words to Calvin. For his part, the baby was sitting up on Mama's lap as if he were the King of England. Everybody was having a bright time. As soon as she let loose in her mind her annoyance at the baby and her mother and all the other cackling women, Johnny May felt ashamed. Maybe it was a good idea for her to stay away from Calvin. Maybe he was safer if she wasn't responsible for him. Over the few months since Calvin had come, she had questioned herself and considered that her parents and Aunt Ina, and maybe some of the neighbor folks, might think she wasn't responsible enough to look out for a baby. She had been trusted with Clara, and Clara had drowned. Was Calvin going to be safe with her? She made up her mind that she was going to look out for Calvin, be a stalwart guardian, but at a distance. She was going to let her mother have her baby to herself. She loved him, truly did. He was soft and helpless now, and sweet-smelling. He was a happy, gurgling baby. And when all of them were sitting around the stove in the kitchen and wiggling their fingers at him, and baby-talking him, Johnny May was happy and comfortable, too. But Calvin was precious to them. He was Papa's precious dream child and Mama's consolation baby. And Aunt Ina shared him. He meant so much to all of them that Johnny May was leery of being too close to him and maybe putting him in jeopardy. It was on account of them. It was because she didn't want them to lose Calvin the way Clara had been lost. Lost because of her. Johnny May meandered back down to a boulder at the edge of Rock Creek. She sat down and pulled at weeds that were holding on like 40, taking pleasure in yanking them up brutally. Her hand closed over the tops of the blossoms and crushed them and tugged them out. "You thinking about swimming, Johnny May?" The voice was friendly and slightly joking. He was gently pulling her leg like he always did. Charlie Hughes had the pleasantest manner of any man she'd ever known. For the children who came to his swimming classes at the Francis Pool, Charlie Hughes was the first adult that they didn't have a prescribed code of behavior toward. He wasn't one of them. He was older and more worldly, a student at Howard University. But though he was an adult, there wasn't a stiff distance between him and the children. When he came upon Johnny May, Charlie had been circulating through the picnic crowd. A big picnic like this reminded him of big church picnics they had in his hometown, Valdosta, Georgia. It was a welcome change from his meals at the university. He had eaten, by this time, 4 heaping plates of food, 1 piece of cake, and 1 piece of pie. The muscles in his stomach were worn out from digesting, and he simply wanted to sit and give his stomach some rest. He was looking for a quiet sitting place when he came upon Johnny May with her face looking like a mud fence. "Oh," she said, turning her head with a snap. He climbed onto the rock she was sitting on and lowered himself down beside her. "You had enough of the picnic? I ate so much my stomach is worn out. Did you have some of the watermelon? They're cutting it up back there." "No, I'm just sitting here." She disliked the babyish sound of her own voice, but he had surprised her, and she hadn't had time to plan out a conversation or pitch her voice to a more mature tone. And looking at Charlie was distracting. All of the girls agreed that he was the best-looking man ever born. "You look like you've got a lot on your mind, Johnny May," he said. He leaned back on his elbows and stretched out next to her on the boulder like a snake sunning itself after dinner. "No, I don't know. No." She stumbled over her words. She could have told him volumes because she did have a lot on her mind, but it was impossible to summon up the words. She wanted to say something, though. She would certainly lose his attention if she didn't hold up her end of the conversation. He'd have to be thinking she was adult by now. But she could tell Charlie wasn't thinking she was addled. Maybe he should have been. But he wasn't. He was reclining there, just taking it easy, being companionable. She thought how lucky she was to be sitting next to him. Pearl was going to be jealous. His placid face had no smirks. It was a wide expanse of amiability.
You know, you're a good swimmer, Johnny May. You've got a lot of native ability. You like swimming?
Well, he must be asking this just to be polite. Everybody that knew her knew she loved to swim. Her papa said she'd have webbed feet if she kept up swimming every chance she got. And Aunt Ina had said that maybe this wild swimming behavior should stop now that she was becoming a grown woman. She answered him with a yes that was so tentative, it made him laugh at her. And she had wanted so much to act mature and hold his interest.
Oh, I think you like it more than that. I've seen you in the water, and I think you like it a lot.
Johnny May and Charlie Hughes sat on their rock for the longest time without talking. The sun, though it was not yet ready to set, had begun creeping its way behind clouds. The sky was light, but the bright yellow had turned pearlescent. The picnickers' voices had begun to soften, and lethargy descended on the crowd. Groups of people sat around on the grass, resting themselves and picking food out of their teeth. Johnny May stretched and looked back toward the P Street beach. The bright sun had wearied her eyes, and they were now in the lower light, only hazily focused. Out of this haze, she caught sight of her mother threading through the crowd. Mama walked alone among the people and appeared to be looking for someone. Seen from a distance, woven in among the others, she stood out like a fancy button on a drab coat. Johnny May studied her mother and was fascinated with the knowledge that her mother had not seen her. Who was she looking for? Maybe somebody had walked off with her precious Calvin. The thought struck Johnny May like a hammer. Suppose somebody had walked off with Calvin and her mother was desperately trying to find him. She didn't look frantic, though, only concerned. But Johnny May thought that perhaps at this distance she couldn't see the worry lines in her mother's face. From where she sat, her mother's forehead was like her cheeks and the skin on her arms. It was soft like pudding. But she knew this was just an illusion, a trick of the distance and the waning light and the heat. Her mother's brow was always slightly furrowed. With her, there was always a concern. She saw her mother stop and chat amiably with a person here and there. But she soon broke away and strained to see around the milling groups. Though observing her mother unobserved was thrilling. A stinging feeling in her gut spoiled the pleasure. What if something had happened? She sprang up from the rock and said, "Bye," to Charlie. He chuckled as she leapt onto the bank and ran off toward her mother. A feeling of being small, being nearly helpless and liking it came over her. On the bank, she lost sight of her mother as she tried to see over the heads of the crowd. The crowd had absorbed her fully, and Johnny May's eyes followed every yellow dress. There were a great many that day. At last, she saw the nape of her mother's neck above the white collar of her flowered yellow dress. She jostled her way through small clumps of people that stood between them and came up behind her. She tapped her mama's shoulder and said, "Hey!" Mama swirled around, and her frown turned to a smile and back to a frown when she saw Johnny May.
"Where have you been so long? We've been looking for you."
So it wasn't Calvin they were worried about. They'd been wondering where she was. They were looking for her. It had not occurred to her until that moment that her mother might be looking for her. She had thought that as long as she could see her mother, feel her mother, scent her mother, she was within the sphere of her mother's influence. Her mother would know where she was. And she had not known until now that she could take herself out of this sphere of mother's love and control. She could take herself away from her mother, and her mother would be puzzled and would not know where she was. It takes a child who is well loved a long time to figure out that she can leave her mother's house just by walking away.
Chapter 22. Alice looked at her daughter standing on the diving tower at the Francis Pool. The girl looked so teeny up there. This change of thinking was odd. Johnny May had seemed all grown and nearly gone for months. And now, up on the tower, she seemed a tiny little chick. The fear Alice had of water came over her. She had never been tested by river or stream or swimming pool. She had always had a little fear of water, even of her papa's stream back home. Alice had a dull stomach full of worry all that morning. She wanted to change her mind and not come to the swimming meet, but she had said she would. Also, Willie was so determinedly disapproving of Johnny May's swimming that she felt she must go to save face. But she did not want Johnny May to see how disturbed she was at the prospect of watching her in the water. And yet seeing her daughter from a distance was proving something. Her child was there, gone off away from her. Clara had done that, and Johnny May was doing it. They had been doing it since the day after they were born. Little Calvin would do it. Little Calvin, whose head was shaped like a perfect honeydew melon, was doing it even now. Johnny May was all of a piece over there. Alice didn't have to worry. A person of so fine a form and grace was her daughter, and she was fine over there. She had moxie, and she was smart, and there was nothing else to want for her. She'd be taking care of the wants for herself. Her mother would hold on to her still, but she could let her go at any time, and the girl would be stalwart. Ever since the incident at the train station, Willie had been admonishing Alice about her daughter, saying it that way, your daughter. Mind your daughter, woman. See that she does right. It's on you to see that she does right, he'd said over and over. Peace of mind and family peace were at stake since the train station. Willie had made her responsible for keeping Johnny May in line. She had said that the girl would mind and that it was best for her to stay. She had set herself up to be the one who would be blamed if the girl made a mistake. How dare he box her into a corner like that? There was something between them now that wouldn't be right henceforth. Things were changing. In that deadly quiet way, things change between two people. There would be brooding and resentment. And if it never flared up to burn them, it would come close to singeing them, surely. The morning was bright and warm, and the crowd of onlookers was large. The team for Baltimore had brought along lots of supporters who were thought to be a bit too rowdy by Georgetown standards. Also competing in the swim meet and the diving competition were boys and girls from Barry's Farm in Anacostia. Plenty of folks had made the long trip across town to see their team compete in Georgetown. The swimming competition was scheduled to follow the diving exhibition, and word got around the milling crowd that Francis Junior High had a powerful swimmer on its team. Press Parker, who'd become Johnny May's most vocal champion, laid down a bet with a man from Anacostia that she would leave the other swimmers in the dust. All the swimmers were poised at the edge of the pool, ready to launch themselves into the water. Johnny May did as Charlie Edward Hughes had told her. She thought of all the lessons, and then she put all the instructions out of her head and simply made up her mind to swim. His voice had been soft and compelling as he'd said it. Just swim, Johnny May. Forget about the techniques and just swim. Girl, just go with all you've got. And it'll be more than enough. Charlie had said that all the coaching she could retain was in her by now, and she'd just have to trust herself and swim. Johnny May dived into the water. Her whole body followed the perfect hole her arms made, slipping effortlessly through the seam. She made no splash. The water in the pool was achingly blue, and she swam underwater as straight as a bullet, following the lines on the bottom of the pool. Opening her eyes underwater, she saw a figure in front of her in the lane. The sight startled her, but did not break the rhythm of her strokes. The figure was like a giant tadpole,
Bubbles of water sat on the figure's very large head and reflected sunshine like glass shards. The figure shimmied through the water and began to look like another girl. Johnny May swam toward her, this girl keeping just ahead. Straight onward they swam, and Johnny May was puzzled that they hadn't reached the far wall of the pool. The temperature of the water became cooler, and its color turned browner. The fragrance changed from the chlorine smell to something nearly putrid. She became frightened at not having reached the far wall and feared she would lose the race if she brought herself out of the water. But the color of the water and the fragrance and the mysterious girl swimming ahead of her caused alarm. She put her head up and broke the surface of the water. She was no longer in the swimming pool. Somehow, she had swum out of the Francis pool. She had swum out of the pool, out of the race, and was following an enigmatic, big-headed tadpole into the middle of Rock Creek. Ahead of her, she saw the figure. Its huge head with wriggling green plaits was above the surface of the water, too. The big-headed figure laughed and grinned and beckoned her onward. It dived below the surface, and she followed. The water closed over her again, and she swam in the silent, cool water beneath the surface. Rock Creek, a snaky waterway through a forest, will take you far out of the district if you follow it. Many a frightened fugitive has waded it and skirted its banks and forded Piney Branch to reach a Quaker in Silver Spring. The water of the pool flowed out into the creek. She swam, following the current, briskly moving past boulders and downed logs, and following the big-headed, grinning figure. She swam into the Potomac and knew it as soon as she felt its particular waters against her skin. She pumped her arms to try to reach the figure swimming in front of her and tag it and say she'd won, she'd beaten it. But the figure stayed ahead of her and kept laughing. The figure continued under the key bridge, and she followed. Up ahead of them, the mossy towers of the Three Sisters' castle appeared. The figure gained the castle ahead of her and took a seat on the rocks. When Johnny May got within inches of the rocks, the water turned tide and pushed her away. She plowed the water and struggled to get closer and tag the figure and tag the rocks, but the water would not let her come close. The figure sat on the rocks and laughed. Her fingers touched the wall perfectly together, and her head lifted. A roar went up when she climbed from the pool. A hand reached down to her, and she grasped it. It was Charlie's hand, and his face was happy. He must have been roaring because his mouth was wide and round. She couldn't hear anything, but felt a rumbling, thunderous reverberation. Charlie indicated the crowd of onlookers, and she turned to see wide-open faces and clapping hands and some caps flinging in the air. Papa Willie was waving his cap like a flag. Her mama danced up and down, and Aunt Ina was jiggling and wiggling and bouncing baby Calvin. Not just the Georgetowners, but the whole crowd was cheering. When she turned back to see the other swimmers climbing out of the water, she knew then she'd won it. She'd beaten them all. The other girls ringed her, clapping her on the back. The End. This book was read for you by Karen Chilton, a member of SAG-AFTRA. We hope you have enjoyed this production of River Cross My Heart by Brina Clark. Recorded books are available wherever audiobooks are sold. Thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.